So maybe we'll just start with a moment of silence together. And what this will do is synchronize our minds together, which is a good way to begin. To just go into silence and stillness. The flame represents actually your spirit. You know, in the traditions of the Native American Indians, there are special gatherings that they have, and they always have a fire in the middle, and they are contained within a teepee, which is round. We are almost round here. And I participated in many such rituals, actually. And I'm hoping that the conversation that we have together this evening might take us to new depths of understanding. One of the things I do very much with different groups of people is something which we call dialogue, which was quite well initiated by David Bohm. I don't know if any of you have heard of his work, but he was very interested in methods by which you can make truth become visible. And he came up with this dialogue system, and I like it very much, so I use it very often. And in the process of dialogue, there are some rules of communication that were also created, which I find very helpful. Because if you want to arrive at something which is true or real, really meaningful, then you have to use mechanisms or methods that are also true and real. And so this little system called No Gas we evolved. No generalization, no accusation, no speculation, and no speeches. A speech is when you say the same thing more than once. You just repeat it and repeat it. Then I call that a speech. A generalization is something many people use, but we determine that it's actually not a good practice, because anything that you say which is a generalization can never be true. Like, all the French people love camembert. It's probably likely that most of them do, but you can never say for certain that all of them do. And when we're talking about different groups of people, it's very easy to forget that these are individuals, and we group them because we decide to, and we make a statement about this group of people, a generalization which is sometimes very offensive to some people in that group who are not having those characteristics. Like, all the rioters in recent English activities need to be controlled because they're fundamentally criminal. Many were, but only a percentage. So this system of being very specific when we want to make statements, we found very, very good. Accusation. People accuse other people or lay blame quite frequently, quite commonly. And when a person makes an accusation, they will be away from their part in the problem. And so when we create a discipline not to do any accusations, we can draw our attention to our part in the process, and we find that this is very helpful. And then speculation, any kind of speculation. You can get people to consider something, and if you tell them enough, they'll think it's true. Tell them frequently enough. But if you're going to say something, you have to provide evidence. You have to ensure that what you are saying actually is the case. And if you say, well, probably you don't like me because you didn't answer my email within 48 hours, it may or may not be the case. So speculation, we're careful about that, and speech, as I mentioned earlier. This evening, we are talking about how to have life, practical life, free from worry and free from pressure. Well, I don't believe that you can have it free from pressure, so I won't take up that. But I do think that it is possible to discipline oneself in such a way that you can be free from worry. And there are many things that are taught to us in the Brahma Kumaris practice and system of knowledge and philosophy that I would like to share with you, because they refer exactly to how consciousness works in regard to whether or not worry is compulsory. Pressure, we define it in such a way that we don't find it something that you don't want to have, but we include it. As you can see, I'm dressed up differently, and so you can understand that spirituality is a word that will come up very frequently in my language, and that really this is where we're going in our conversation today. And so I want to perhaps see if we can define it a little bit. I find myself that the word spirituality is used to mean hundreds of different things which are not necessarily agreeing with each other. So what I mean by the word spirituality, I think it's good to clarify. And essentially, the spirit is the self. A spirit means a being, a human being, a human spirit, who manifests through this physical body that we all are occupying. And the spirit is permanent. The spirit is inextinguishable. The candle is a symbol for the spirit, except that, of course, it will eventually blow out. But it's a very valuable symbol. It's an analogy that works for many aspects. A candle will blow out if you have a strong wind, or even if you have not a very strong wind. So these things that we call worries and pressures are like winds on a candle which blow it out. That means to say, when a person is conscious of their spirit to the point where you identify with that, you say, I am the spirit. I am the life who animates this form, and I think I have the capacity of consciousness. So, you know, it's a little bit the other way around from Descartes' I think, therefore I am. We would say, I am, therefore I think. So we're starting from a different direction. The soul is another word that we use probably more than the word spirit. The soul is the being who has existence independently of our earthly life, as well as through our earthly life, or our earthly life is its manifestation in the short period of time between our bodily birth and our bodily death. So spirituality is then to focus one's sense of attention, one's focus on oneself, that I am the being. And then you look at another person as that also. So spirituality would imply that I would not see your external identification only. I will see behind that. That who is the person? What is their atmosphere, their vibration, their intention, the quality of their integrity, their purity, these kinds of things, which in order to discern, you would use not your five senses, but you would use another capacity. Some people may put it as intuition, but perhaps we want to go even more deep than that in the practice of what I do, which is called Raj Yoga meditation. So in that practice, you see the different capacities of consciousness. You have the mind, you have your power of understanding, your discernment, your discretion, your ability to endure, your ability to see through what is untrue and perhaps perceive what is true, what is sustaining, what is real, your individual personality, which is distinct from every other individual and which is who a person is. So there's a what a person is, looking at consciousness, and then going deeper into that, a who is that person? What makes that person function the way they function? What is the frequency of their particular spirit? Like as if you have a piano with so many different notes, and each note has a particular frequency, and you can make chords where the notes are in harmony. They may be in major, they may be in minor, or they may be cacophony. You know, they may be completely out of harmony. And if a string on a string instrument is out of tune, then the vibration that that string makes is something that you don't really like, especially if you're a musician, and you will like it when it's in tune. This is also an analogy for an aspect of the human spirit, where the human spirit can be in harmony, in tune, or it can be out of tune. When talking about spirituality, we also will look at things in terms of their opposite or contrast. And so we will contrast the body and the spirit. We will contrast the consciousness of materialism in opposition with contrast of spirituality. And when we say spirituality as opposed to materialism, it doesn't mean a disregard for matter or an attitude that material prosperity is somehow negative. We actually wouldn't subscribe to the idea, like sometimes is said, money is the root of evil. We would not say that. We would say more that money is neutral. Your relationship with it can be positive or negative, can be responsible or irresponsible. You may be greedy or you may not be greedy, but do not blame money because it's neutral. That is spirituality. Materialism, in that definition, would be, I think I am an object. I think I am a body. That would be materialism. I think I am a being. I express myself through this material body. That would be spirituality. Materialism, I think I am a body. Maybe I have a spirit. So it's a kind of opposite way around. I say, I am a being, I have a body. Spirituality. I am a body, maybe I have a spirit somewhere, materialism. So then you also find you get a comparative value system. You have a material value system or materialist value system, or you have a spiritual value system. And one of the things that we think about the world today, which is a general thing, is that on the whole, most of the people will mix up material values and spiritual values. There's a sort of a confusion. You will have a set of spiritual values, purity, love, integrity, honesty, things like this. But then you'll mix into it certain things which might not really be spiritual values, but which may be material values, which go actually in opposition with your ethical principles, which would be based on spirituality. And there comes perhaps the very difficult question of punishment. You want to have a society which is harmonious, and you want to establish a set of moral values which everybody likes and adheres to, and then you can have a society that's running smoothly. But what you have is some situations in the world today which you can't really do anything about. You see, many people will say, well, there are too many people. And it's true, there are too many people. But too many for what? Some people say, well, the earth can provide enough for everybody's needs, but not for everybody's greed. That's a very often used little statement. Maybe there's too many people for everybody to have enough, as long as who needs more than enough also has more than enough. Do we really want to become clones? Is that a value? Do we want everybody to have the same thing? Do we really think that everyone is equal? Because if you look, everybody has a different face. Everybody has different taste. Everyone has a different capacity for compassion. We are equal in a very, very basic way, but as soon as you come into action, there you see wide varieties of differences. And so spirituality sees those differences, accepts those differences, tries to work with those differences in such a way that there's harmony. maybe more like an orchestra than a totalitarian or egalitarian society. You see, you give everyone love. As a person, you give everyone love. Some people will respond to it better, some less well. You know, probably most of you have children. Some of your children may be very academically developed, some may be artistic, some may be having emotional problems, some may be susceptible to illnesses. There's huge variety. And really, I think what spirituality tells us is you have to see each person on a case-by-case basis very, very individually. And when you form judgments or decisions about a person, it has to be done very, very individually. So spirituality then requires that you have a very good power of discernment. And how do you increase your power of discernment? If somebody lies to you, some people, they say, you can't lie to me. This is bad. Another person will not even realize that you're telling lies. Another person will know you're telling lies. But it's okay, because I know you're lying. So you can't lie to me, because I know. So it doesn't matter. The problem is really not that the person is lying. The problem is you got deceived. So this is why spirituality takes it back to yourself in that sense. You're all the time trying to bring it back to my part in the problem. And materialism in comparison will be more externalized and see the other person's part in the problem, but I'm not involved. The ideas of holism that started to emerge in the last 20, 30 years or so will say, you know, like in science, the observer affects the experiment. And so how does the observer affect the experiment? Can you affect it positively, negatively? What is this observer effect? You see? And spirituality will very quickly tell you what that is, because the human spirit, the human soul, affects matter very directly in quantifiable ways, discernible ways, but it's very subtle. And when you think that you are a body, you don't take it into consideration, and you say the effect of the observer is not the effect of me, the effect of some other observer. You see. But spirituality will make you look at things much more subjectively. Materialism, we talk a lot about objective reality. But then your objective reality is still talked about by someone who is a subjective person. If you want to see something, whether you see through your eyes or through a microscope or through a telescope, the telescope does not see something. The microscope does not see something. You see something. Even in spirituality, we would say that your eye, your actual eyeball, is a lens. It's not that different from a telescope, microscope, camera. It has a lot of capabilities of refocusing and so on and so forth with the muscles. But who sees what is seen? Who will say, I like this or I don't like this? You know. Who will say, this is important? Well, this is not important. Criteria are there, you see. And these criteria come down to actually more spiritual factors. So who sees through your eyes? You. You say your eyes. Who is the possessor of those eyes? I see. My eyes. Or you say, like I'm speaking, you're listening because of your ears. It's a sense perception. And this sensory information comes into our eyes and our ears, and then we process it. We say, okay, it's processed in the brain. And you can actually even pinpoint different areas of the brain related to different sense organs. But still, the brain is called my brain. Who is the owner of that brain? I see. So spirituality gets us to go deeper and deeper and try to find who is me. Who is the self? Who is the owner of this brain, these sense organs, this world that we have at our disposal that we can use however we want? You know, who is this I? When I say I, you look in the mirror, you say, that's me. But it's not really. It's your body. So spirituality will consider that the self is the animating energy that gives life to the body. And so when death occurs, which it inevitably does eventually, then what has happened is that self has come out from the body. And then you say, this is a corpse, or you say, this is the remains belonging to someone. You say, but you cannot say, this is that person, because what you do say is, he's gone, she's gone. You say, where? How do you know she's gone? Or you say, well, they're not breathing. That's true, but then why do you say they're gone? So there is something in us that discerns whether the person is there or gone. And of course you can't track who goes or where they go, because that force of life, we would say, that soul is invisible. It doesn't have any material aspect. It doesn't take up any space. It isn't coming into being at a point in time and then no longer existing at another point in time. You know, you have a tombstone and it will give you date of birth, date of death, and a small line about this long. That's your life. That's very insignificant when it's written in that way, you know. But who is the one who presents themselves through the physical means and interacts with other people to form significance in human life, you know, because we're not just animals. A biologist will say it's human animal, it's a mammal that, you know, does all these things. It gets born, it grows, it eats, it reproduces, it dies. But that is not what our life is about, you see. So what gives our life significance is the soul. And so spirituality is then an exploration of this phenomenon, trying to really put your finger on clear definitions, and also doing it in a subjective way. because the soul doesn't have a material form or duration or location, you cannot approach it in the same way that you approach the study of matter, which is science. So you have to do it from a different angle, which is subjective. And this is why meditation becomes part of it. You say, okay, I am a soul. And you try to feel that by turning your attention within, you see, because you have a mind which is different from your brain, you see, because your mind is a word we use for when the soul is producing thoughts. Those thoughts are immediately captured by the brain and translated into physical action. But spirituality says that the origin of thought is actually the soul. So when a thought arises, and the soul thinks. So as I said earlier, I am, therefore I think. Or not even that, I am and I think. And the soul is all the time thinking something. Could be positive, could be negative, could be boring, could be interesting, could be meaningful, could be harmful. So there's this other element, capacity of the human soul, which is, it's true, it's not true, it's good, it's bad. It's real, it's not real. It's worthwhile, it's not worthwhile. This is a capacity of the soul. Works together with the thought. You think, you evaluate, you think, you evaluate. You absorb information into your intellect and you work with it. You make decisions and then you make that a physical reality, which is either successful or unsuccessful. Think about this house that we're in, you see. I was talking with Henning about how it was put together and all of the thinking and choices and reasons why you would do it in this way and all the different obstacles in order to put it together, you see. Do you come at it from a perspective of the material side, the spiritual side, other considerations, you see? And if you see you have something which is very holistic, very harmonious, it will contain the spiritual elements, the material elements, but the material elements are guided and informed by the spiritual principles. And in materialism or matter, we used to talk about the five elements of matter: air, earth, fire, water, ether. And then you have the chemical table of elements, which goes to around 190 or so. But the fundamental elements of the material earth that we live on, and our body is put together in the same proportion as the planet. You see. Planet is 60% water, you are 60% water, your body. So this earth is the only place in the universe where you get the necessary combination of elements so you can have a body. And you can walk around and breathe and have flowers and trees and buildings and boats and all of these things, which is very extraordinary. And then the soul, the elements of the soul, purity, peace, power, personal power, love, bliss, is the essential elements of the soul. So spirituality means consider that you are a living being who's fundamentally pure, peaceful, powerful, loveful, blissful. You think, you evaluate those thoughts, and you bring that into action through the body in this earth, and you interact with other human souls, other human beings, you know. And this is why we can say life is sacred. Otherwise, there's no really good argument for the sanctity of life unless you take those things into consideration. So now, how does that apply where we say, I think there's too much pressure, and I think I'm consumed with worry from time to time, which is the theme that we're looking at. If you're fully loving, loveful, peaceful, powerful, pure, blissful, you are so strong, you are more having your integrity than any external thing. So when you're full, there isn't anything like pressure or worry. It's when your levels of purity, peace, power, love, bliss get low, and you were talking to me about the shadow. Shadow becomes big. Shadow is, you know, the opposite of the light. And so if your levels of love are very low, then that space, which was occupied by a lot of love, becomes then a shadow of love, which can perhaps be hatred. And if your levels of peace are low, then that shadow that is left behind can be anxiety, disturbance, fear, this kind of thing. So what spiritual practitioners are concerned with is to evaluate what is the actual current condition of the soul, how these levels have gone low, very low, and then what is required to raise them and deal with the shadow. And so we have another whole side, which I won't go into now, about the light and the dark through cycles. But for the purposes of this discussion, the soul then has to have access to a source to be able to restore these levels to their original fullness. And that source is beyond. It's a spiritual source which cannot be found in the earth. But you can go to a source beyond with your mind and your intellect when they know how to access that, when they know how to focus outside this. So spirituality says you can be within matter, but just as easily you can go beyond matter. You are not limited to matter. And so therefore, if you experience pressure, then what you need is resilience and flexibility and personal power. Now, where is that supermarket where you can buy that? You see, we have to go to a higher source, a higher power, a higher being, a higher soul, which is also what spirituality is about. To to evaluate clearly what am I, who am I, what is happening, and what is needed, where to get it from, and how to fill. And as you fill, you're also using these as an energy, right? You'll use it on a daily basis. Just like your body, if you don't give it food, if you don't give it exercise, if you don't give it rest, it will break down. But if you also don't attend to the soul, it will also break down. And so spirituality says we have to attend to the body, but we also have to attend to the soul. And so when you're experiencing pressure or pressure in life, a worry in life, then spirituality would say you haven't attended to your soul. If you attend to your soul, you can handle pressure and you're not going to worry. But why you're not going to worry, I'm not going to take up that right now because I've already talked for a long, long time, right? And that's a whole nother area of the ideas that we work with, the concepts. But I will stop here, and then maybe you have some thoughts that you'd like to add to this, some questions, some reflections, and then we can. And you might like us to pause for a minute and just, you know, focus on the symbol of the soul to just this kind of rather detailed description of spirituality. It's probably a bit more of a definition than you might have expected, but it's actually very deep. There can be many, many more elements that one could bring into it.
If I understood you right, the needs would be worry and feel under pressure when our soul doesn't have the right level.
In a way, yes. The bit about pressure, the bit about worry, I hesitate to go into another half an hour description because that's a different thing. I can do that if you would like me to, but it's really a different thing.
Worry.
Worry, yeah.
But it would be of interest.
Would you like me to?
It is very essential to have a strong soul. And would you be so kind to tell us the recipe the Brahma Kumaris have to get this strong soul? Is it by means of meditation? Is it by means of looking inside? What is the technique?
It's that and a few other things as well. It's not really a technique. That would be too easy. And if it would work, everybody would have done it a long time ago.
Isn't it actually beyond technique?
Yeah, it is. But then we have to find some description so that we can put it into words that are meaningful. So that's why I want to perhaps maybe go into this second area of the ideas that we work with, because as far as I hope I understood it right, you have children, what kind of a world are they living in, how are they going to be okay, you have to worry about them. I think we also need to make a distinction. Caring and worrying, very different. You see, you have to protect them. You have to educate them, prepare them, teach them, you know, empower them, reinforce them to the very best of your ability. But you cannot control all the circumstances that will befall them. It's out of your hands. So the wise thing is to be very knowledgeable yourself and do the very, very best that is necessary to prepare a child to handle a dangerous world where opportunities for employment and good relationships and so on and so forth are getting compromised more and more. And the future looks dangerous, if not bleak. So this is absolutely right and real. And it's not really that Brahma Kumaris are saying to you, oh, don't worry about that, because that's very superficial. If you are very strong in your purity, your power, your peace, your love, your bliss, that state of being is extremely nurturing for your children. Extremely nurturing. Because what children need, what anybody needs, is someone reliable, somebody solid, somebody that they can go all around the world and come back to, you see, as a mother. And if the mother is all over the place and hopelessly disturbed and then not very useful for the children, believe me. One thing that's definitely very, very helpful for your children, your neighbors, your friends, your anybody, is if they know that there's somebody that they know who is serene, who is strong, who is undisturbed by disturbing things, you know, that's a very valuable person to have around, you see. So that's one thing. Then you have something in you which we call attachment, you see, which is not the same thing as love. In the terms of the shadow part, that's part of the shadow. Attachment can be described as emotional dependence. Though these are your children, if anything happens to them, it happens to you. You see. And so also if anything happens to you, it happens to them. So this is the attachment between parents and their children. And it can have a negative impact where it's very clingy and you don't allow your children to make their own life, to discover for themselves, you know, because human beings are remarkably resilient, and I go back to that word resilient. What is it in German? Resilient means that you survive the unsurvivable and you still manage to be okay no matter what, and you kind of bounce back. In a way, you're not going to be broken very easily. You can manage. So resilience is a very good quality to have. And in resilience, a certain amount of flexibility is there, and you will, you know, you'll not get easily threatened, you'll not get easily undermined, you hold your ground, you're strong, you're steady, you're stable, you can manage. You can get through the problem. And so that's a very, very good thing to have. And resilience is an indicator that you have really been sustaining your soul and you have been really developing your love, your peace, your power, your bliss, your purity. There are things that we talk about in our practice which we call powers of yoga. And these are very good to have. For example, you have power of tolerance. You see? And power of tolerance means that you get attacked verbally or undermined or whatever. You can, you know, you also have to have your discrimination along with your tolerance, and you can say, okay, this is the game. I know what the game is. I'm not going to play that game. And whatever it is that's coming to distress me, I can flex with it. It will do this, but you'll stabilize, and you won't break, you won't go in the wrong direction or anything. Tolerance, you see. Tolerate pain.
Just in the beginning, you that pressure is something which we don't want to have.
No, I didn't. I said, in the theme, you were asking me to talk about how to not have pressure, but I don't want to talk about that because I don't think it's worth trying to remove the pressure. But instead of that, really, again, there's resilience. But whatever the pressure is, if you have resilience, it doesn't really matter.
Yes, that's exactly my point. I mean, our experience, all of us, is you cannot really avoid pressure.
Right.
Pressure is there, it's a fact, it's there every time.
Mm-hmm.
And the question for me is more how to handle it.
Yes.
And how to work with it.
Yes.
And perhaps sometimes pressure may be even a good thing.
Yes.
In some cases.
Definitely. Yes.
So I would like to go a little deeper in that point.
Yes. You see, there is this concept that we have, which we use the word drama. Drama. Yeah. What is drama? Cinema, theater, all these things. Drama is like this concept. A soul is an actor. So we are actors. This earth is a theater. We come on this earth, we find ourselves in situations, we play roles with each other. And this goes on in a very complex and very broad way, covers the entire surface of the earth, probably including the sky and under the sea. The soul, who is a performer, and performs all these different roles, but the idea that we practice is I am not my role. And the thing that happens, you can use this expression, I don't know if it will help you, but it very much helps me. It is happening, but it's not happening to me.
Pressure.
No, it doesn't avoid pressure, it avoids worry.
But you are involved. I have concern.
You're not really involved. You're there, you're present, but you are not limited by it, you're not necessarily affected by it. You remain, we call it the detached observer, a kind of witness consciousness. But the problem for most people is it's very difficult for you to remain emotionally neutral about things that you are attached to. This is why the attachment is considered a big obstacle. Because if I say, these two people are behaving badly. They should not be behaving like this. Let me see what I can do to alter the situation. You could maybe make it worse. Whereas if you look at it, okay, there are these two people, they're having a go at each other, and you consider the situation very carefully, and you may find that you need to not interfere, because if you do, they'll both start hitting on you. That's what normally happens. There is the thing called the 12-step program. Have you come across that? The Alcoholics Anonymous and all of that. So in that program, they really did a lot of work to figure out some approaches to very catastrophic situations. And they came up with quite a good little sentence, which I find very relevant from a spiritual perspective. And they say, always remember, you can't change it, you can't stop it, and you can't control it. And this is said to the parent of a drug addict or the wife of an alcoholic, or because big problems happen when the victim of somebody else's addiction tries to change them, control them, and stop them. It doesn't work. It always is worse. And they get so involved, they call this in English enmeshment. You know this word? And you are like, you are living, yeah, you become so caught up in this person who's troubling you that you start to live their life and you don't live your life. Your life is gone, forget it. You're like suicided, but you're still alive. You see, this is, from a psychological point of view, you will know this, extremely toxic, very unhealthy human behavior, but it's very prevalent. And not just only in identifiable addictive situations, it's in many families. There is a what they call a dysfunctional family relationships. And one of the things that happens, somebody tries to stop it, change it, control it. And the therapist will say, you have to quit that. You have to be detached. And they'll say, I can't. And the therapist will say, you must. And they'll say, I can't. Because they don't have power, you see. So for me, the element of spirituality which changes the equation is that you learn to take power, you see. And this is where not only we talk about I am a soul, there is a drama going on, but I have direct access through my mind to the Supreme Soul. This we also say, you see. So there's a big thing. That's a very big thing. But you can imagine that if you say the Supreme Being is the source of spiritual strength, which is what people do say in their prayers, you know, they address God, give me strength. Well, he will say, well, take some. He will say, how? You see, this is the recipe. Yes, this is the important thing. How is it accessible to you? Think about it. In your innermost part of your being, you believe that there is somebody like that. Yes? Is that right? This is a private matter, but most people is like much too private to say, but it's important. If you believe that there is God, then why do you have such a belief? See? You will not be able to easily answer that question. To some extent, the idea of it has been introduced to you through your parents, maybe your teachers at school, maybe your church, you know. But there are some people who say, nah, there isn't. And some people who say, yeah, there is. There isn't really, you can say, proof or disproof. But there are many things that people come up with to add weight to their particular take on it. The anti-God people will say there's no God because of this, 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 and this reason. Or the pro-God people will say there is God because of this, this, this reason. But you still will say, I don't have access. So what can give you access and what prevents the access? So this thought that I was telling you about thinking of the self as a soul, not a body, means that I am a spiritual being. Now, all these other people, they're also spiritual beings. These are my brothers. Souls are brothers. So there is a father of souls. Otherwise you can't be brothers. There's a family connection between all the human souls. And in that sense, we are all equal. We're all equally brothers. If you get a female body or a male body, then that will make you brothers and sisters. But if you don't have a body at all, then your relationship would be brothers. And God is bodiless. No physical form. And the word that is used is incorporeal. Means one who doesn't have a body and is yet a soul. We are incarnated souls. The soul is in the meat, in the body, the meat. And so because of having a body, we can talk to each other, see each other, but we cannot have access to that because we are in body consciousness. We are thinking of ourselves in terms of our body. So we begin to shift that and think, I am a soul, I have a body, I'm not a body. And you can move yourself in your thinking from being limited to the material plane of existence. You can understand by your intellectual processes that there are certain implications of this idea. And that is that if I am a spirit, then I have access to the dimension which is spirit. And the vehicle for traveling there would be my thought or my mind. Now God is also called incorporeal soul, supreme soul. That means I'm a soul, God is also a soul. I see. So I can have contact with any brother soul I want through the body. But I can also think of you and have contact mind to mind. This is possible. Some people call this telepathy. And people are not usually very good at it because your mental powers are very ordinary, very everyday, because they are underdeveloped, but it can be developed. Now, you can send your thought to God, and God can send his thought to you. You have a connection. Because if you say, okay, I'm a soul, you are my mother and father, I have rights. Right of access, definitely right of access. And then you have to say, okay, God, make yourself known to me. Those who want access, who are interested in access, then they will follow through with that. And those like you who breathe, they will say, this is enough. You cultivate that connection. You cultivate that relationship. Because you see, somehow or the other, which is what is a differentiating factor, if you have in your heart somewhere this thought, which comes out as, I do believe in God, or I believe there is God, or even I know there is God, but I don't know where he is, or she, or it. Oh, I don't know what it is, but I want to know. You see, there are people who say, there is God. I'm a person like that. I have two brothers. One of them is also like that. The other one says, nope. There isn't. Oh, okay. Not a problem. But then you wouldn't want to pursue this line of investigation. So those who feel that, they will do that. Because there is a thing inside, I don't know quite what to call it, maybe a chip or something inside, which is love for God. And not everybody has that. And those who have it, pursue it. They just, you know, keep on finding this way, that way, or the other way. They like the sunset because somehow it reminds them of God. They like the ocean because somehow it makes them feel closer. There are all these associations that exist. And so the meditation that I do, being one of these people who does love God, so I want to make that connection. I have one very interesting experience. It was very, very early on in my spiritual seeking, and I experienced somehow that I was suddenly, and I was about 18 at the time, long, long ago, suddenly I was catapulted out of my body and, ooh, very far away beyond the universe. I was like, ooh, what is this? And then I'm kind of feeling around me. I'm without a body. This is just an experience that I don't know how it happened, but it did. It was a strong thing. And I experienced that I'm not alone, that there is another presence out there. And this was such a strong feeling. It was nothing more than that, but it was still strong enough to settle in my being that, yes, there is God, and it's out there. And I can also go out there, and it is out there, and that's where it all happens. And, okay, so kind of put in the filing cabinet. It is there. And I know that some people have it and some people don't have it. And if you look in the major religions in the world today, some are theistic, some are non-theistic, some are pantheistic, some are a mixture of all of it. So if you see Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they're monotheistic. And then you have Hinduism, which is all sorts of things. There is God, there isn't God, there's lots of gods, and anything goes, basically. So it's very flexible. They do, but then they still, I don't know, I was a sort of Anglican when I was raised as a Christian, and my interpretation of what was being told to me is there's Jesus Christ who's the Son, and then there's God who's the Father, and then there's the Holy Spirit, which is a spiritual manifestation of the pure form of Christ. And so they say three in one, one in three, but I always have thought, you know, there is God, you see, and then there is also Christ. But I know that there are a lot of Christians who don't differentiate, but I always differentiated, and that's just me. Definitely.
Christian people, for example, when they are a little bit worried about Father, Son, and then they go to Maria.
Right. Yes. This is also good. But there's a very beautiful saying in Christianity. I don't know who said it, but I like it very much. They say, be still and know that I am God. Have you heard about that one? You know? And some of the teachers of Raja Yoga, they do tell us that if you become still, you will become aware of the God. And that's also a very nice thing. But just becoming still, going into silence is very, very good, and very few people can do that. So you're very ahead. You can do that. One of the things that we were mentioning earlier on, if the soul is empty and wants to go to a source to fill in those areas where it's empty, that God is also the source. So that if you go in your mind to God, then when you connect, just as if you put the plug in the wall and you can turn the light on, but if you chop the wire, there's no current. So this idea of connecting to be able to actually take the power and that energy or light, I think it's really light, which is also a kind of energy light that comes when you make that contact, will take the form or sort of split itself into these five elemental qualities of purity, peace, power, love, and bliss. And people who meditate in this way do pretty much universally experience that when we connect, first you have to remove your consciousness of the body, which is like a sort of insulation on the wire, and then just stick your plug in and turn on and pull in the power, you see. But it's very subtle, you see, because, you know, to make your mind focused, you also have to be still, which is where the stillness really comes important. Be still. Detach from your body. That means you're detaching from movement. You're detaching from your involvement with the drama. You see? You're saying to the drama, I put you on pause. Press the pause button. I'm going up to get a drink. I'll see you in a minute. And you can come back actually quite refreshed. And, you know, one thing we do quite often, you find yourself in a highly pressured time, you'll say, okay, time out. Put the drama on pause, and after a few minutes, you don't feel the pressure. Nothing's changed, but you've changed, you see. And so you become refreshed and say, okay, you know. And even sometimes a very nice thing happens. When you do this, you go into a very still place, and you get the right idea what should you do next. It comes. Because when you're, you know, agitated, pressured, worried, you can't think. You see? And all this attachment and ego and all these shadow areas, they come and disturb your ability to see clearly. So, stopping, taking time out, I'm an actor, this is a drama. Anyway, in addition, we have this idea, everything is destined. It's happening because it's happening. It's supposed to happen like this. So what that idea does is it takes out, what if? Oh, if only I had done it that way, then it would have come out this way, you see. That takes a lot of time and energy, the what if only. You know what I mean by this? Mm-hmm. And so then you say, okay, another one. It's not good, it's not bad, it just is. That helps, because you stop. If you say, this is bad, this is horrible, da-da-da-da-da, it goes on and on and on, and then you drain your energy, you see. But if you say, okay, it's not good or bad, it just is, then you kind of accept it. And then another thing that we are taught to do in a drama, I mean, I still do media, video. Huh? In NTSC system, you have 24 frames per second in video, you see. They're like photographs, 24 of them in 1 second. That's how NTSC video is. Here you use PAL, a slightly different number, maybe 26 or 28, I'm not sure. But I was in America working with NTSC. So, these are photographs. These are stills. You know, like cartoons, lots and lots of slightly different pictures, and you put your finger through it, and it looks like it's moving, but it's really lots of stills, slight differences. So 24 frames in this drama per second. So in 1 second, you're seeing that much. Now some people, what they do, this is mind control. You slip in a frame of something else in those 24 frames. One of them is a different picture. And then what you do is you introduce a thought subliminally into somebody's mind. This is mind control. It's not a very good thing to do, but it can be done. Now, if you, as a yogi, you say, okay, there's a drama going on, and it's all this many frames, and I'm the audience. I'm also in it, but I'm also the audience. I look at it. It's a drama. And I don't want to be caught up in it. I just want to see it neutrally. Whatever it is, it is. It's not good, it's not bad, it is. And then your next thing is two things. One is let go, and the other is two questions. Does this scene in drama demand that I act or that I refrain from acting? I see. Because in destiny, there's like left foot, right foot as you move along. One step is destined, one step is free will. And you have to see with your discernment, is this a moment where I have to exercise my will, or is this a moment where I have to be detached and allow it to be what it is? Oh, this is not so easy, but you asked. But the thing is, you see, you practice. And actually what we find is talking about it together, then going away and practicing, coming again and talking about it together, actually we slowly become more skillful, we become better at it, we encourage each other, we get clearer about it, and we actually move forward. I mean, you can't become a perfect yogi in 5 seconds. Huh? Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it's, I suppose it takes you back to that very nice book of Voltaire, you know, Candide. It's very well known. Il faut cultiver son jardin. Finally, that's what you have to do, is cultivate yourself in the face of all these ups and downs. Yeah. Well, if you're interested, you'll do it. Why would you discipline yourself just for the sake of discipline? It's all, you know, it's too hard, you know. But, you know, really these things are quite fascinating, and especially when you have a gathering of like-minded people to bounce off some of these ideas, it does inspire you, it does give you insight, and you feel, yes, you know, this is worth doing. You know, because your life, you have your mundane life, you have your private life, you have your social life, you have your philosophical life, and you have your spiritual life. So you have all these different dimensions of yourself going on. That gives richness to your life. And then you want to integrate all these different parts so that the symphony of your life is a very beautiful one.
How do you handle injustice? Mm. Because you arrive in a sort of cage, like animal, and you know this real continuously when injustice has happened to you. Can you push this also in front of you and say, I'm not concerned?
We have to, but you know, again, as I told you, the no gas, we go to specific instances of injustice, and then you think about those. And your question was an injustice that happened to me. And so that's happened quite a lot. And I have found, amazingly enough, that these instances of injustice have forced me to do a lot of work inside, and they became catalysts for my high speed advance. So though they may be injustices, they became useful and profitable. So, you know, I could be quite neutral about them. At the time, they're very nasty things that happen. And when you have these things a number of times, you get slightly better at managing them. And eventually, you become quite amused because you say, oh, here it is again, whether it's character assassination, which is, I've been through that a few times, or whether it's somebody takes your work and publishes it with their name on it, been through that, and then they say, well, you didn't do this properly, so I had to do it properly. So then you get insulted in the middle of that, and then somebody takes your place, somebody takes your money, somebody this, somebody that, all sorts of things happen. But eventually, looking at it through the eyes of it is the drama, and then there's another thing is, whatever it is, there is a possibility of profit. So if you can personally discern where to take the personal profit from it, then whatever it is that they wanted to disturb you with or destroy you with or whatever, that's not your problem. You're busy taking the profit. And so, okay. There's also the whole thing of the laws of karma. So if somebody does an injustice to me, they will pay, not me. You see. Because you figure out how to manipulate your perspective on it. If you take it at face value, it's much more problematic. But if you look at it from various different angles, and you look at what we also learn as something like the three aspects of time, see everything in terms of the past, present, and future, how this thing came to be, what exactly happened, and then where is it going? See it in that level of holism, then you would say, okay, well, maybe it was unjust, but in the larger scheme of things, it didn't actually do any harm to me. Now, then if you think of injustices to other people, which there are millions of injustices to other people, and they're extreme, you see. So then if you would consult with God and say, okay, what should we do about the injustices in the world? He will give you a very special instruction. You want to hear it? He will tell you,
But you have to develop so much power in your mind that you can make a thought sent to one who is the victim of injustice to relieve that one's pain so that it is gone. This then becomes the duty of yogis. But you have to be very good at it. But this is how we are taught.
Then when the person passed away.
The person passed away, but they're still there. This idea, which I like, nobody gets lost. They're here somewhere. You can send your thought to them.
But it's a loss of energy.
And well, if you
want to stop that because you feel it's dripping out of you, then you have to stop it.
There's a wonderful movie on YouTube which is called Stop It. And you will like, have you seen that? Oh, you must. It's all the psychologists in England play this, you see.
Stop it.
Stop it. And then there's this person who's come to see the psychologist and says, I've got a terrible problem. And the psychologist says, okay, I will solve it in 5 minutes. 5 minutes? Yes, very expensive, and it's this much money, 5 minutes. 5 minutes? This much money? Yes. What's your problem? I'm afraid of getting locked in a box and buried. Well, stop being afraid of it. Well, I can't. Well, you have to. And then it went on and on and on. You've seen it, yeah. And in the end, he says, if you don't stop it, I'm going to put you in a box and bury you. So you better stop it. And it's very clever. Because it's telling you that if you want, you can. If it increase the willpower, then you can let it go. You have to practice. But see that little YouTube thing. It's very enlightening. Yeah. So, anyway, thank you very much for inviting me here. It's been a delight to see you and feel you and hear you. And maybe we can just have a couple of moments of silence to conclude, and then we go downstairs. So in the silence, consider yourself as a tiny star. Infinitesimally small, absolutely beautiful, you are the life in this body, the animating force. Of the soul is the center of the forehead. Feel yourself there. And become aware that I am the soul, the life. I am not this body. Essentially pure, peaceful, loveful, powerful, and blissful. I detach from this body. Know myself as a pure being of light, eternal and immortal. eternal child of the eternal supreme being. To whom I have complete access. If I want. And then gently let yourself reconnect with the world of everyday reality.